It's a rare and wonderful thing when we get a chance to talk with Hollywood royalty. Our next guest on the program has appeared in classic films like Pal Joey, Picnic, The Man with the Golden Arm, Bell, Book, and Candle, and her acclaimed performance as two different characters in Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo. She pretty much walked away from the movie business in the 1960s to find herself and to pursue other art, including painting, poetry, and songwriting. She has led a very, very interesting life, and we are thrilled to be joined this afternoon by the wonderful Kim Novak. Well, first of all, thank you so much for making time for us today. It is a delight for us to get the opportunity to talk with you.
Good. I'm looking forward to it.
I watched the wonderful CBS piece that was done recently with Mo Rocca, and it showed the art exhibit, the show in Ohio, with your art on display, and you were there for the opening of that exhibit.
Yes, it was my retrospective, which is, quite an honor. I'm so thrilled. To me, it's better than an Oscar.
Well,
I recognized for my life's work.
I have to say, watching that, it seemed like that outlet, which is what you intended to do all along in your life, provides you with all the satisfaction and perhaps more than you got in your acting career.
Much more. Well, because I felt, of course, when you appreciate it, it always feels good. And I never felt really appreciated in Hollywood. I mean, at least not by my reviewers. I think it's much kinder now. I think that people can understand a little bit more about who I am and who I was. And I think at that time, in the 50s, 60s, acting was more popular rather than reacting. I'm a reactor rather than an actor.
What's interesting, too, because I think everybody who watches movies or television shows has an image in their mind of what that life is like. And I'm sure it was hard for some people to understand why you would largely walk away from that when you did. But when we see the way you have lived your life in the years since, it becomes abundantly clear that that was a wonderful choice for you.
Well, it was. It turned out, you never know when you leave something what it's going to do, but how it's going to affect you. But sometimes you've got to make up your mind and do it for whatever. And it turned out perfectly because I felt reborn, actually, after I left living in Carmel, Big Sur. I did. I actually felt like I was, for the first time, finding out who I was, who I am.
Do you look back on it now almost as if your acting career got you sidetracked from your real passion?
Well, that's true. It did. It interrupted my, I would have definitely kept moving in that direction. But as it turned out, I think it was a sidetrack, but it was a good sidetrack because I learned a lot from directors like Alfred Hitchcock. And in my art, I don't know if it's because of my influence from Alfred Hitchcock or not, but I love creating a mystery. I like painting where it looks like one thing when you first look at it, but if you really study it, it has other meanings. And so there's a lot of mystery in my work, and that's why I like to write poems oftentimes to go with my paintings, to give clues. It's kind of like Alfred Hitchcock when he drops clues in different places. Well, in my painting, I've got clues written in my verses to help explain my paintings while they look, as I say, you can't always judge what it is, what the meaning is.
I want to talk a little bit about your work with Alfred Hitchcock and what is hard for people to believe, a movie that did not get overwhelmingly great reviews at the time, but 60 years later, people look at, as in some surveys, the greatest American film ever made, Vertigo. And I understand that you identified with the two characters you played, but especially Judy and Jimmy Stewart's character's efforts to mold her into the person he wanted was, to you, perhaps similar to what Hollywood wanted to do with you.
Exactly. I think that's why the role came fairly easy for me, in the sense that I identified so completely with the studio trying. They hire you originally. They find you, and they find something special in you. But then they go about trying to change everything about you so that it's to their image. They want to play it safe. So they want to say, well, let's see. let's give her a Marilyn Monroe mouth, and let's give her the eyebrows of Joan Crawford. I mean, and so they go about trying to make these changes, and it was a struggle for me right from the beginning, trying to, what I actually used to do was go into my room or go into a bathroom on the set and take off some of that extra makeup and stuff and try to bring a little back of me. I think it made a difference.
You had a good working relationship with Alfred Hitchcock, and he really let you have some say and some influence into the development of your characters.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. What Alfred Hitchcock is, he's really technically involved with all the different things like the music and where you stand and how fast you are delivering your lines, things like that. But he never gets into your mind. He always hires people that he feels have whatever it is he's looking for. And so what I loved about working with Alfred Hitchcock was the fact that he allowed you to become the character in your own way. He doesn't tell you how to think. He tells you where to stand, how to dress, all of those things. But he allows you the freedom of your mind. And that was the most important thing to me. It always has been. I need to find my own feelings about it. And he never messed with that. But he sure messed with the wardrobe.
Well, yes, and it was that that gray suit that has become so iconic that, as I understand, you didn't want to wear because it was uncomfortable. And that was sort of the point he wanted to make. He wanted your character uncomfortable.
Exactly. And it was so interesting because I don't know. And then he had me wearing black shoes. Well, I always felt like a dark shoe is sort of grounding you to the earth. And I thought, oh, no. And so when I discussed it with him, and he said, I want you to wear that suit and those shoes. And then I went home and I thought, gosh darn it, I don't want to wear that. I don't like it. And then I thought, oh, of course. That's my clue on my character. And so that discomfort that I had when wearing that suit and all paid off because it was the character. And yet on Judy, he said, now you can wear any color shoes you want to. And I said, oh, good, I don't want to be grounded. I want same color as my legs. And he said, great, you do it. Because he wanted me to feel at ease as Judy, although as he starts to change her, she gets very uncomfortable because she's being put back in all the things. So it worked out perfectly. A good relationship with that director.
And how was the relationship working with your co-star, Jimmy Stewart?
Oh, you couldn't be better. I was so fortunate because, you know, I'm a simple person from Chicago, never studied acting and things like that. And to work with Jimmy Stewart, he was the same kind of person like I am. He's a reactor, he was, or is, I mean, in heaven somewhere. But I mean, in other words, rather than being an actor, he was a reactor. And both of us did. We both reacted to the opposite character, I to him, he to me. I mean, it was just ideal.
And you would work with him again in another wonderful movie, Bell, Book, and Candle.
Well, that was one of my very favorites. It was wonderful. And Jimmy was so perfect for that role. And I liked being a witch, a good witch. But yeah, that was a wonderful movie. I loved it. Jimmy Stewart's the best person anyone could ever be around or, you know.
We're talking with Kim Novak here on Dantan, and you've worked with so many talented people through the years. But I have to say, one of my very favorite performances of yours came, I think, a year later, 1959, with Frederick March in a great movie, Middle of the Night.
Oh, yes. I adored that movie. The studio did not want me to do it. They said, don't do it, because they wanted me to be in glamorous roles. But the role that I played, I just adored and I identified with her completely. And it was wonderful to be a kind of person that maybe needed a father image, someone to something she didn't have. And of course, it was just, for me, a wonderful experience. And to work with Frederick March, who had been a movie giant for years, as the older man with a young girl, finding a different kind of relationship. It was wonderful.
Now, you worked early on. You were signed to Columbia, and you had some battles with Harry Cohn, but largely the biggest battle was over your name And you wouldn't back down from that.
No, I mean, I felt, especially if you hear the name they wanted to call me. They wanted to call me Kit Marlowe. Well, I could not identify because, to me, that wasn't a real person. For one thing, they said, oh, we're going to write up the fact that you used to be called Kit because of a kitten like you. And I don't identify with a kitten. I love cats, but, I mean, that's not who I am. And so I did. I held it. And also, I think, well, roots are really important. You've got to feel that you came from somewhere in order to go somewhere. And so it was important that I kept my name. Very important to me.
And was it your idea to bring back that name that they wanted to use when you played Kit Marlowe in Falcon Crest?
Oh, well, you've done your history. You've checked it out. Yes, it was. It was because when I left Hollywood, I left it. But on the other hand, when they suddenly had this, and I thought, you know, I feel like doing something. I'd like to see what television is like. And I said, I'll do it, but I want to be called Kit Marlowe. And that worked out fun because then it made it really fun for me to have that tie-in.
There's been so much attention, deservedly so, paid to the Me Too movement in the last couple of years, and you came up in the business at a time when studio heads were often all-powerful and took advantage of young actresses. How were you able to hold your own and protect yourself in those situations?
Well, it's true. Me Too existed then, very much so. But I, well, for one thing, Harry Cohn was the boss, and he wanted to make sure that he had people working for him that would respect him and listen to everything he tells. And so he had no interest in trying to find a girlfriend with someone he wanted to work for him, because he wanted to be the boss. But, of course, there were always the producers and people that you met along the way that would test and see if they could seduce you. Luckily, I was always very independent and had a mind of my own. In fact, that made it difficult sometimes with some directors I worked with. But I was able to be in control of myself, of my own body and my own mind, and that's what mattered to me. And so I had issues with it, with people trying to become like that. But I feel I was lucky that I was strong in that.
We heard a friend barking in the background there, and I wonder
that's
if you could...
That's my little dog, Patches.
Well, could you talk a little bit about the importance of animals in your life? Your husband is a retired veterinarian. What is your love and the love you've received back from animals meant to your life?
Well, it's everything to my life. I've always felt a great closeness and attachment to them. But interestingly enough, when I left Hollywood, I got several different creatures, and one was a goat, and a wonderful little African pygmy goat. I just loved him. Anyway, but the thing is that he taught me a real lesson, that you have to, and when I left Hollywood, it was to find myself, in order to find out who I really was, what do I really stand for, because you get so confused when you're playing all different roles. Mm. Every time you played one, you left with a little bit of that character still attached somehow. And so when I got out of Hollywood, I thought, I'm going to get some animals. I want to get an animal particular that would be not, like, a dog is going to love you no matter what you do. I mean, some awful people do terrible things to the dogs, and the dogs love them. So I knew that I could find a dog that would love me. But I thought, I saw this billy goat, and I thought, I wonder what this goat... And interestingly enough, we became one of my very best friends. But if I would ever wear a scent, like a perfume or a whatever, he didn't trust me, and he'd want to get me with his horns. And so I learned so many lessons from different animals. In fact, that's the book I really wanted to write. It was called Creature Teachers, because they teach you so much. When I left, again, I didn't want to be influenced by how much money I had or how I looked. And so with an animal, they're not judging you by what your wealth or or anything like that. So you really got to know who you were because of how they treated you. Did they love you? Did they respect you? And that you earn from animals, especially the wilder the animal, the more true it is that they are, that you can find out who you are and what you stand for.
No question about that. We mentioned your art. You talked about your poetry. You also have done some songwriting through the years as well.
As I did, as a matter of fact. Harry Belafonte recorded one of my songs. It wasn't a hit, but I did the lyrics for it. I used to go with someone that was a musician. He worked with Nina Simone. And so we would oftentimes sit out on the ocean on the rocks, whale watching, and he'd be playing. And I'd always written poetry since I was a little girl. And so I just started writing, and we sold quite a few of our songs. As I say, no big hits, but we did them. And they were pretty good, mostly folk songs, but I love to write.
People can get a look at some of your art at your website, KimNovakArtist.com. It has been such a treat and an honor for us to have a chance to talk with you today. Thank you so very much for making time for us, and we wish you continued good health and success.
Thanks. It was very enjoyable talking to you. You have a good time, and hi to all your people out there. I'm sending you love all the way.